Welcome back to Integral Voices, convened and produced by the Center for Transformative Learning at Meridian University. I'm Bailey Murphy with Meridian University's Center for Transformative Learning, and I'm glad to be introducing today's conversation entitled Nurturing Our Humanity, Reuniting Care and Economics, featuring Rian Eisler, Hazel Henderson, and David Corton, and moderated by Aftab Omer. This conversation was recorded live with a virtual audience interacting with the speakers. Integral Voices is a video and audio podcast found on all podcast platforms, including Spotify and Apple Podcasts, as well as YouTube. To stay updated on upcoming episodes and to explore the archive, please visit meridianuniversity.edu/integralvoices. And now, on to our conversation on nurturing our humanity, reuniting care and economics.
Thank you, Bailey, and welcome everyone. Our three panelists have a remarkable body of work that they have produced over decades. And likely many of you are quite familiar with this body of work. I know that the ideas from this body of work have shaped many conversations at Meridian University over the decades. So it's a delight to have them together during this 75 minutes talking with each other. And we will begin with some opening statements where about 5 minutes each, where we can hear from each panelist, beginning with Rian, something about their personal journey that has informed their core ideas that are expressed in their body of work. And then after these opening statements, we will begin to apply the core ideas to our theme for today, which is reuniting caring and economics. So over to you, Rian, to begin.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Aftab. And it is a real pleasure to be here with you. And I want to welcome you all again and to say how very grateful I am that Hazel and David have joined us. Hazel and I go way, way back. And it is just delightful to have you here. And it's delightful to have all of you. On a very personal note, I think that those of you familiar with my work know that the passion I have for this work, Nurturing Humanity, Nurturing Our Humanity, is actually the title of my latest book that came out with Oxford University Press in 2019. And of course, reuniting care and economics is a big part of what I've called the shift from a domination to a partnership system, where I introduced in my book, The Real Wealth of Nations, the concept of a caring economics of partnerism. And of course, Hazel is much cited in that book. But the passion that I have for this, as some of you know, is really deeply rooted in my early childhood. As a refugee child from Nazi Europe with my parents. Because from one day to the next, my parents and I, we became hunted with License to Kill. And it was very traumatic, and I won't go into the details of Kristallnacht. But I saw that night not only when a bunch of Nazis broke into our home and dragged my father off. I not only saw cruelty and insensitivity and destructiveness, but I also saw what I today call spiritual courage. And that was the courage that my mother displayed. She recognized one of the Nazis as a young man who had been an errand boy for the family business, and she got furious. I mean, how dare you do this to this man who has been so kind to you? I want him back. Now, my mother could have been killed that night because so many Jewish people were killed on Kristallnacht, which was the first official Nazi terrorism against Jews. But by a miracle, she wasn't. And by another miracle, we escaped to Cuba. I grew up in the industrial slums of Havana. Yes, I experienced and saw poverty and the injustice of the enormous gaps at that time between those on top and those, you know, the haves and the have-nots in the Cuba of that time. And all of this really led me to the questions that animate my work. The question of, does it have to be this way? Does there have to be so much cruelty, so much insensitivity, so much destructiveness when, as I saw in my mother, we humans have such an enormous capacity for consciousness, for caring, and for creativity, because what she did unconsciously was a very creative thing. And it was years later, obviously, that I started my multidisciplinary, cross-cultural, historical research. And the answer to that question of, is there an alternative, was a resounding yes. But, and this is what I think, my 5 minutes are almost up, so I will leave you with that. But in order to see, even recognize that alternative, which is a partnership rather than a domination, social configuration, where yes, things that we had learned to just ignore or marginalize at best, gender, childhood, the value of the so-called women's work of care, right? I mean, how can we really bring care and economics together without elevating the status of women and the so-called feminine? And of course, story. We've been told crazy, inaccurate stories. Well, anyway, this was my work, and I want to recognize my husband and my partner, David Loy, who has been such an enormously important part of this journey of mine, who supported me, my way out ideas, you know, because Chalice, which was, by the way, just published in Spain and has created a sort of a Spanish media storm, you know, at País, all the major newspapers are all over it. But it came out first in 1987, and it is more relevant today than ever before. So, but David, through those 10 years of research for Chalice, which was the first book reporting my findings, he was there for me. And he said, yes, of course, because it was so completely different at that time. I mean, I've always been ahead of my time, but the good news, and I really will stop now, is that the times are catching up. And people, including the President of the United States, are talking about human infrastructure, which is a term, natural infrastructure, human infrastructure, that I coined actually in 2007 when The Real Wealth of Nations came out. And of course, caring economics, which got co-opted to only mean the care economy, but that's okay. It's a beginning. So I've shared a lot with you, and I really look forward now to hearing from Hazel and from David.
The times are changing, and over to you, Hazel.
Thank you so much. This is such a treat, it really is. Well, just very briefly, I grew up in Britain in a very typical patriarchal family with a rather violent father and an incredibly loving mother. who managed the relationships. How she ever did it, I'll never know. And then when I came to the United States and became a US citizen, much later, of course, I was in New York City in the 1960s. And as soon as I became a citizen, I became very excited about the power I had, levered by the at least hundreds of other American citizens who didn't bother to vote. And I thought it was so wonderful to be able to vote. So I launched with a couple of women friends in the play park, taking care of our little children. I launched a group called Citizens for Clean Air. And we were dealing with very contemporary issues, since air pollution now causes about 9 million excess deaths in cities around the world. But we started and we realized that there was that one of our platforms for our group, since we realized that so much of the pollution in New York City was actually coming from Detroit, from automobile tailpipes. And so we looked rather widely, and that was when I began to realize there was something terribly wrong with economics. And I spent a good part of my life examining that more closely. But we, in a very simple way, we went to our then aspiring young Senator Robert Kennedy, and we took him on a helicopter ride around New York City to show him all of the pollution. And we explained to him that one of our planks was to correct the GDP, which we said in our very simple way, added all up the goods and the bads up into this crazy sort of gross national product and gross domestic product. And so our plan, which we asked Senator Kennedy to help us with, was to subtract the bads, the pollution and the illness, and the lead paint, you know, that was making children sick. There was lead in the gasoline and all of that. And it should be all subtracted, and we should have a net kind of GDP. And Senator Kennedy went on to make that very famous speech at the University of Kansas, and saying all of the things that was wrong with GDP. And we were just thrilled to kind of put the issue on the map. And fast forward, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has just introduced a bill now in the Congress, which she has 40 co-sponsors for, to do exactly that. And she is proposing to install the Genuine Progress Indicator. For many years, we have been back and forth, the people who were developing that, and very much in agreement with each other. And this does include the unpaid work, which is always more than 50% of everything that goes on, all the productive work in all the societies. And of course, this is completely unknown, because, of course, it isn't conducted in money, so it's not reflected in GDP. And so this has been very much of a mission of mine. And after I served in Washington as a science advisor in the early 1970s to the National Science Foundation, the National Academy of Engineering, and the Office of Technology Assessment, I began to realize, oh, there's a much bigger story here. There is a giant sort of global transition going on, which is based on evolving human awareness of how the planet really functions. And we're moving from fossil fuels to what I called the solar age. And so as soon as I left that job, which was actually only advisory because I was writing and organizing as well all the time. But I wrote this book, The Politics of the Solar Age, which came out in 1981. And I was saying that this was an inevitable human transition based on our evolving knowledge of how the planet actually worked, and that these kind of transitions in the energy sector had been going on since we went from iron to to coal, to whale oil, to you name it. Basically, that book sank like a stone, even though it was published by Doubleday and got a very good review in many good journals, as well as a lead review in the New York Times. But that was the time, 1981, that Ronald Reagan came in and took Jimmy Carter's solar panels off the White House and said it, we didn't need anything like that. You know, there was no such thing as climate change, which we had actually been looking at the Office of Technology Assessment. And so I just began to go around the world wherever my book was translated. And it's now in about 800 libraries in 20 languages. And I expected, you know, at this time in my life, I would be able to do more of the writing and thinking and pondering that I love. And instead, suddenly, everybody is suddenly realizing that climate change is with us. And of course, what we have been doing, you know, I got into the whole thing of realizing all of the new technology, solar, wind, energy efficiency, LED lighting, you know, electric vehicles, all the things now which are going mainstream with double digit growth and investment and all of that. We began tracking them at the company I started and still run called Ethical Markets, Ethical Markets Media. And we have been producing a report every year since 2009 called the Green Transition Scoreboard. And we decided to push the all of the people in governments, you know, who were meeting with the committees on the parties. You know, there was the big meeting in Copenhagen in 2009, you know, which was a complete train wreck. Everybody, you know, naming and blaming and shaming about tier one countries who were doing the polluting and tier two countries that were innocent, you know, and having to take all the effects. So instead of that, we decided we would be tracking every year the private investments which were going into solar, wind, all of the technologies of the solar age. And our model was that if there was going to be at least $1 trillion every year between 2010 and 2020, by that time, there would be so much in the pipeline on the other side of the ledger that we would enter the solar age and leave the fossil fuel economy behind us. And so that's what did emerge in our very last study, which was last year. Our cumulative was $10.3 trillion already in the pipeline. And of course, now we have all of the effects of climate change all over the world now driving the acceleration of really addressing finally the issues that we have to address if we're going to survive. And so those investors who are still stuck in these stranded assets, in fossil fuels, in meat producing companies, and all of the things that we have to really leave behind us, they are all trying to say, no, this is going too fast. We're going to lose our shirts. And we're saying, no, you're just on the wrong side of history. All you have to do now is to shift your investments into all of these new companies, the plant-based foods and beverages that are growing at double-digit rates. And we can make this shift in the 10-year window, which the IPCC says we have to do it. So we try to bring the good news that this is possible, since so many other media concentrate on all of the bad news, very important, but at least some of us have to look at what the possibilities are. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Hazel. And over to you, David, who has been helping us understand the story under the story over these many years.
Thank you, Aftab. It is truly a privilege to be here with so many friends and discussing these foundational issues of our time, issues that are really pressing us to think at a much deeper level of what it means to be human and what our human possibilities are. And, you know, to be with Hazel, who I figured out long before I met her that there was something terribly wrong with conventional economics, but she was such a treasure in terms of helping me understand why. And then meeting Rianne and our relationship, which actually directly led to my writing the Great Turning from Empire to Earth Community, which became an international bestseller. She's the one that brought a deep historical, evolutionary perspective to my work, and her fundamental frame of domination to partnership. And then off top, we go back, I think it's to the beginnings of Meridian University, and it's been many years, but it's wonderful to see the progress you've made. My current work focuses on the human transition to an ecological civilization. It's basically a civilizational transformation, recognizing the 5,000 years that Rianne lays out so beautifully of the human, in a sense, entrapment in the dominator frames of empire, of which we're now seeing the consequences playing out in a way that actually threaten human self-extinction on this beautiful planet Earth. Much of my work centers now on recognizing the extent to which we humans are a species with a distinctive capacity to choose. And our most fundamental choice is now between competing to dominate and partnering to secure and enhance the well-being of all. Not a small challenge, because we now face a global emergency. The outcome of the 5,000-year imperial civilization defined by competition to dominate is destroying the living Earth's capacity to sustain life, while at the same time driving an extreme and growing gap between rich and poor that is stripping our existing institutions of their legitimacy. And this is now rapidly unfolding global environmental and social collapse creates a global imperative and opportunity. And this is the fundamental message of my work currently. The imperative and opportunity to transition from the dominator systems of the now collapsing imperial civilization to the partnership systems of an emerging ecological civilization dedicated to the well-being of all that is now struggling to be born. And the egonomics of domination that drive the collapse will not and cannot guide us in making the choices this transition will require. We have urgent need of an economics of partnership to provide maps that guide us in our path to the future we now absolutely must create. Now, in terms of my own history, my childhood is a little less dramatic than Rianne's. I grew up in a small town, a very prosperous small town in Northwest Washington in the United States. And my family had a family business, and I grew up assuming that I would take over that business and that would be my life, and I would live forever in that small town and be happy ever after. It turned out that I went to Stanford for university, where I started out as an economics major, but I knew nothing about what it meant to be educated at that point. But I did figure out very quickly that the economics that I was being taught was bullshit. And I transferred to psychology. But I ended up getting my MBA and then my PhD in business. And during that time, I went through Air Force ROTC. This was during the Vietnam War. And that led to, of course, to military service. And I had delays all the times I was getting these degrees. So went in as a captain and actually had a very interesting experience because my assignments included literally orienting, in classes for pilots going to Vietnam to drop bombs, educating them in all the research, including the classified research I was then had access to, letting them know this really surprising finding that if you drop bombs on civilians, it makes them dislike you and increases their will to exist. As you put this together, you recognize that most all the wars that we fight now with conventional military means are unwinnable because you cannot distinguish between the enemy and the civilians who you want to be your friends. So I was learning about the deep dysfunctions of our current very dominant institutions. But I also had a time in the office of the Secretary of Defense as a military aide to the civilian that managed all of the social and behavioral science research in the United States military. And we became very aware of the racial conflict problems that were a serious problem in Vietnam at that time. And I wrote a little memo proposing a research program that would lead to programs to try to address that, went up to the office of Secretary Melvin Laird, who was then Secretary of Defense under Richard Nixon. And he had a better idea for how to deal with that racial problem. That was to deny it. It doesn't exist. And that's where I learned about the limitations of our large bureaucracies it's basically the limitation of centralized bureaucracies in being able to deal with what are fundamentally local problems. So then I went on and I had my years in international development, first of all, setting up a business school in Ethiopia under Haile Selassie, Emperor Haile Selassie, spending years living in Central America as dean of the MBA program at the leading business school in Latin America, and then later living for 15 years in Southeast Asia and Philippines and Indonesia, working on the problems of trying to transform development aid, including a time in which I was a senior advisor to all the U.S. aid missions in Asia and the Pacific, on how foreign aid had to be transformed to work effectively with people on the ground to strengthen their control of their own resources and their ability to manage them rather than stripping them out of their homes and shipping them off into migrant agricultural laborers or as sweatshop workers in factories all separated from their family and community. So these were the years of learning about the deep dysfunctions of the system, which led to what I've been engaged in for roughly the last 20 years, which is working with the citizen organizations, with civil society around the world on deepening understanding of why our existing civilization is threatening us with self-extinction and what the alternatives are and the challenges of reaching them. So and that led to writing When Corporations Rule the World, which is the book for which I'm best known, international bestseller, and quite a number of other books that all deal with my search for what are the answers? What are the alternatives? Why do we so often dysfunction as human beings, despite the incredible potentials we have to do so much better? that are now potentially in our reach, but we have, you know, as Hazel has noted, science tells us we have to navigate a significant part of this transition within the current decade, or it may be too late. So back to you, Aftab.
Thank you so much, David, for your comments and for what you chose to do with your productive life and the gift of your work. I should say, though, David, that you found the bullshit in economics, and I found some bullshit in psychology as well. And Rihanna spoke about it doesn't have to be this way. And Hazel spoke about the wrong side of history. And David spoke about our capacity to choose, and towards the end of his comments about denial, how denial functions. So Rihanna, I come back to you with this first question after the opening statements. You have, from The Chalice and the Blade in 1987 to Nurturing Our Humanity in 2019, you have kept at it in terms of gathering the research on to refute that it has to be this way. So to pick up the thread there, and accept the case that our three panelists have already made, that it doesn't have to be this way in their body of work, and turn towards reuniting care and economics, where we are in our historical moment, Rian. Where do your thoughts go as we are at this threshold?
Well, first of all, I want to thank both Hazel and David, not only for what they said, but for everything that they have done and are doing. And David, of course, you too are prominently mentioned in The Real Wealth of Nations, as you know. And I want to thank Aftab for the opportunity to really, the three of us talk about what is the fundamental urgent issue of our time, moving from domination to partnership. And I think that we are at a point where we have to recognize that the struggle for our future is not between capitalism and socialism. The COVID-19 mm-hmm. pandemic showed that we need both government policies and we need private markets as well. The issue is, what will they have as their priorities for investment of their resources? And that takes us really again to going beyond the four corner, beyond the contemporary conversation, to the four cornerstones that I've proposed. And I want to say that I agree, Aftab, that we are at a bifurcation point right now, as Irvin Laszlo would say. And that I wish I did think that the outcome is inevitable, Hazel, but unfortunately, I think that it is only inevitable if enough of us really become social activists and accelerate this shift from domination to partnership in all areas of our life. Mm-hmm. I want to return to what David said about denial. You said it in passing, but I think that this is one of the greatest obstacles that we face And in nurturing our humanity, as you know, Aftab, this is a book that draws very, very heavily from neuroscience. Draws from other disciplines too. But what neuroscience shows is that our brains develop in interaction with our environments, which are for humans mostly cultural, of course, and are very different depending on the degree of orientation to either the domination or partnership side. And that if we are going to really complete, not to a perfect society, but complete the shift to what David and Hazel and I are really all passionate about, to a society governed by an ethos of partnership rather than domination, of other people, of man over man over woman, race over race, religion over religion, and yes, humans over nature, that we have to look at something that is ignored in the conventional conversation, which is childhood. Because what the studies are showing is that people who grow up in domination cultures and subcultures, as mediated largely, of course, by family, but also by religion, education, etc., they develop a very complicated psychosocial dynamic in their brains. In fact, we know that people from these environments, the part of our brain that helps us be resilient and adjust to change are less developed. And that study is, by the way, in nurturing our humanity, as are many other studies. So this is why childhood, and this is a long-term thing. Now, fortunately, there are trends in this direction. We at the Center for Partnership Systems have a free online caring and connected parenting guide. And it's in Spanish as well as in English. And what it really draws from is the latest neuroscience again, showing that for our brains to really not go into denial, which apparently 70 plus million Americans did when they voted for Donald Trump. And the studies show, and I'm being nonlinear with you for a reason, because I want to communicate a lot of information, but there are two studies that have not received publicity, which must receive publicity. One of the things that people who voted for Mr. Trump had in common was a horror, a dislike of what they consider to be too assertive women. Women want to be, in men, that's great. Aggression is even considered masculine, but in women, she's a bitch. Well, that's how they feel. But the second thing, and this is also, the first study is in nurturing our humanity, but the second one I did not become aware of until after the book was published, is that when it came to their parenting styles, these people were much more interested in conformity, in obedience, rather than in curiosity and self-development. So this is why one of the cornerstones has been ignored to shift, has to be focusing on changing parenting. And there are trends in this direction, national trends. I mean, Sweden in the 70s passed the first laws saying that physical discipline in families is against the law. Well, why? Because what do children learn in those kinds of families? They learn that it's okay, it's even moral to use physical violence by those who have control over those who do not. Even, and it's absolutely absurd to say that it's it's a crime to hit a stranger, but it's not a crime to hit a small dependent child. The second is gender, and I can go on forever about it, but we have a gendered system of values. And until we unpack that and stop talking about just being nice and talk about why is there always money for prisons, for wars, you know, the so-called masculine, right? But, you know, the punitive male head of household, right? Or the hero as warrior, but somehow we don't have enough or haven't had enough money for caring for people's health, for caring for children, for nutrition. I mean, for paid parental leave, it doesn't make sense. The third, of course, is economics. And yes, joining care and economics is critical. Caring not only for people, but caring for our natural life support systems, which if you think about it, for both Marx and Smith, caring for people, as well as keeping a clean and healthy home environment, which translates into a clean and healthy planetary environment, was just women's work, reproductive work to be performed for free by a woman in a male-controlled household. We need to understand where both came from, both capitalist and socialist theory. And that translates immediately into what Hazel spoke about, GDP. You know, what is considered valuable. And of course, story and language. So I've gone on for a while, but I just wanted to give you the bigger picture.
Could I jump in and respond a little bit to two points? Of course, I agree with everything that Rianne said, and I have just done a rave review of her book, her new book. But the two points she's raising about, I talked about inevitability, the inevitability of the shift of technologies now to the green future, you know, solar, wind, hydrogen, all of the future technologies, which we could have been using if we had learned from the original technology on this planet, which was from plants, that is photosynthesis, how to harvest the free photons every day, and that is the basis of our food supply and everything like that. So there's another stream of inevitability, which I think I could, I was trying to illustrate in that editorial I did over the weekend called Women's Rights Are Human Rights, because basically, quite contrary to the conventional story, there's the conventional story at the UN, which is that the human family will top out at about 10 billion, somewhere around 2100. Instead, the evidence is in now that this is a very good book written by a couple of Canadian statisticians in 2019 called Empty Planet. And basically, they looked at almost every country in the world, north, south, east, and west now, and found, Lord knows what's happening here, is that women are not electing to have so many children. And often under great duress, they learn how to do their own conception. Preventing conception by sharing information about the morning after pill, whatever it is. And they found really that now you've got countries, whether it's China or the countries in the European Union, all below fertility rates. And guess what? The GDP measured development that they rely on for their quote economic growth, all measured in the price system, basically relies on population growth. So you now have all these governments exhorting women and trying to provide incentives of one kind or another for women to have more children. And guess what? We're not doing that anymore. And even in China, where they now say, okay, you can have three children now, the Chinese women are saying, no, my gosh, you know. And guess what? More and more women are electing to be single parents. And they don't want to get married because they don't want to be dominated. And so in a strange way now, there's an inevitability here, which goes along with the amazing strength of women to empower themselves. You look at the women in Afghanistan today, in the streets, risking death and torture, demanding rights. And so that's another one of the inevitabilities that we need to look at now. If we just can really get the word out that women's rights are indeed human rights. And I think now when you hear people like the Reverend Al Sharpton, who's leading the fight for voting rights in the US, and he totally agrees. He said that women's rights are integrally and totally wrapped up in voting rights, civil rights, and the fights now are coalescing as a new kind of coalition that we haven't truly seen before. So I want to just throw that out on the table. And also the fact that I have never really wanted to have a new economics, because I always thought economics was so badly flawed that I needed to transcend economics. So I've always called myself a futurist. And I have an article now on reforming the politics of polarization, all this left-right, communism versus capitalism. That was all from the 20th century. And basically what we have now, we can recognize that markets and money were two very important and useful tools that humans created. And we've used them for centuries, whether we use the money as shells or wampum or tally sticks. And all of the indigenous peoples in the world have always traded with each other. Yes, we love to trade with each other. But what we have to learn now is we have to get rid of all the conceptual detritus of economics and just sweep it away and take a fresh look at what we actually have to work with, which is money and markets. And there's many, many areas where markets and money are the best and the most appropriate way to innovate. And in other areas, they create catastrophic market failures, like in climate and in healthcare. And what we're learning now is to be discriminate and very, very careful about when we apply markets and money, and when we go to what we call pure science-based investing, when you don't use the price system, because the price system is a function of human ignorance. And so having all of our macroeconomic statistics from GDP to all of the other things that guide our lives and are sending us over a cliff, we have to realize that many, many aspects of our lives cannot be denominated in the price system. And when I created the Calvert Henderson Quality of Life Indicators with Calvert back in 2000, we had 12 aspects of quality of life. Only three were conducted in money. The others were conducted in the most appropriate scientific metrics. For example, urban air pollution, you wouldn't measure that in money. You measure it in parts per million of junk in the air. So that's the shift I'm looking for now, is to science-based investing. And our last report is called Transitioning to Science-Based Investing.
Thank you, Hazel. While the followers of Milton Friedman were starting fires, you made the extraordinary move to link the word ethical with markets. And people thought, what an oxymoron, but it cuts to the chase in terms of Rian's emphasis on culture and values, and that until we connect ethics and market. The markets will lead us over a cliff, as you said. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. David, we need a new story about markets. The historian Will Durant famously said that civilizations, he was speaking about the Babylonians in particular, but said generally civilizations begin stoic and die Epicurean.
I'm sorry, what?
Die Epicurean. The contemporary way to say it is would be die consumerist. Mm-hmm. And so if the great god consumerism is not driving the markets and something else is, what is the story, what is the culture that would constitute the enabling conditions for a ecological civilization, as you termed it?
Yeah, very good question. I'm sure this must be a little confusing for people listening because we're flipping between so many different topics. I want to follow up on your question there in terms of business and economics. And then I also want to come back to the issue of women. And kind of an interesting question comes to mind. What are women for? That's a very dangerous thing for me to put on the table, but... On the business side, you know, part of my experience that I didn't mention is that number of years that I spent teaching on the faculty at the Harvard Business School. This was back in the 1970s. And it was a very interesting time in terms of what was happening to business. Because prior to that, it was a very clear idea that the corporation existed to serve all its stakeholders. And it was just at that time, and I experienced it in what was going on in the Harvard Business School faculty, of a shift from business as a service to the community and to the society, to business as simply a mechanism to maximize the profits of the already richest people in the world. That was a huge shift. And that's the trap we're in now. And it points to the, you know, one of the examples of the depth of the institutional transformation that has to take place. The truth is that the way the current system is organized, even if you have a corporate CEO of a major corporation that recognizes the emergency to fundamentally change how the economy works and the role of corporations, that CEO does not dare to advance that transition because he will be taken over by a private equity firm or something of that sort and will be fired. And has no control over that, which emphasizes in part the depth of the change, the institutional change that's necessary, as well as the depth of the challenge to civil society, that and the need for essentially for partnership that brings together, I can't say all humans because that's quite an impossibility, but enough of us have to come together with a shared commitment and a shared vision to fundamentally change these institutions. And, you know, in terms of the corporate system, it basically has to be broken up and simply converted into various forms of worker and community ownership, which again gets back to it. It's neither capitalism, which is, you know, the predatory private economy, or socialism where government owns everything, but to get in one's mind the idea of people owning everything, but people owning what is essential to the well-being of their community in the place where they live, and that's part of the shift that we have to navigate. Now, the other piece that kind of comes in between this and my little rant about women and how much we need them currently, is the fact that we talk so much about rights. But we're just, some of us are beginning to realize that there are no rights without responsibilities. Mm-hmm. That, you know, community takes work. Building community requires work on the relationships and work on building all of the things that are essential to the well-being of the community. And that's work, and that's a responsibility that we all share. Now, at the same time, to make that work, to be creative, we also have to have a degree of individual autonomy so we can raise questions, the kinds of questions that Hazel and Rhianna spent their lives raising. But do it in a way that brings the community together and we find new solutions, recognizing that where we must go now is a place where no one has ever been before. And therefore, no one knows how to get there. It's something that we have to discover together through that partnership that Rhianne talks about. Okay, now let me make some comments about wisdom, women. You know, Rhianne, when we first met, took me back to the earliest human experience. You know, the way people lived for most of the 200,000 years before the rise of what we call civilization, but it's really imperial civilization of you know, the men grew up to go out hunting and fighting enemies. Wow. The women grew up helping the children, raising the children, and building community, and maintaining the health and well-being of the community. And women learned about a community and how to make it work. They learned how to be caretakers. Wow, men never learned that. Now, those are exactly the women's skills are exactly the skills that are absolutely essential to our well-being going forward. You know, and we men need to learn more of the women's skills, I think much more than the women learning the men's skills. Kind of a radical idea, two of our leading feminists here, but you know, again, years ago, one of a defining experience, some of the most important experiences of my life were simply, you know, conversations of maybe no more than 15 or 20 minutes. Many years ago, one of my woman colleagues noted that women face a challenge in thinking about what they're trying to achieve. Is their goal to become equal opportunity exploiters in an exploitative system? Or is their role to lead in the transformation of that system so we no longer have a dominator system? And it's always struck me as one of the most wise statements I've ever heard, and it has such implications for all the identity politics that we're caught up in currently. And one of my most prized associates, Mamphele Ramphele, who is a leader of the South African anti-apartheid movement, an extraordinary individual, in a paper I wrote where I talked about gender, she said, "Don't even talk about it. She was she said, "Don't talk about race." I've actually had some of my other women friends say, don't talk about gender, that's not a defining issue of our time. We need to get beyond it. It's getting beyond the identity politics and recognizing that we're all human and that we have to come together in fundamentally new ways. As to learning to live together as community.
So.
David, I have to disagree with you on one point, and it's a very important point. The evidence let me go to nurturing our humanity for a moment.
I'm sorry?
I had been working on nurturing our humanity for about 7 years when I invited the anthropologist Douglas Fry to be my co-author. And one of the reasons I invited him is that he is probably the world's leading authority on the societies that you mentioned, foraging societies. Mm-hmm. And he calls them the original partnership societies, and men did not dominate in these societies. And war is only at the most 5 to 10,000 years old. So the notion that the men always did these nefarious things is not factually grounded. And I think this is very important, because today we call men to re-examine their quote masculinity. That masculinity is inherent not in men, but in domination systems, socialization.
Oh, yeah.
For the role of man over woman, man over nature, race over race, etc. And I urge you to really look into that, because what it does is it doesn't paint men as the problem, or it is not, it's as you would recognize being such an enormously skilled systems analyst, it is systemic. It is domination systems, whether it was Hitler's Germany, Khomeini's Iran, the Taliban, whether it was Stalin's former Soviet Union, they all have as a top priority either maintaining or imposing a rigidly male-dominated, authoritarian, highly punitive family. Now, we've got to recognize this. This is built into domination system, and it's very early on what so many men are trying, including you, are trying to leave behind, is that early socialization that to varying degrees men have been exposed to, and women have bought into this as well. So when you talk about your friend who says, you know, I've always used the women's metaphor, and I'm shifting now, saying, you know, we don't want a larger piece of the existing economic pie. What we want is to bake a more just, more sustainable, more caring, a better economic pie. And that is a struggle that women as well as men are fighting against their socialization to value the so-called masculine, but it's artificial. And I think that we really, yes, we have the capacity. I mean, our question, the question that, and I'm going to stop after this, that animates my research is precisely finding out what kind of social configuration supports or inhibits the expression of the capacities that really make us fully human for consciousness, for creativity, for caring, or because we also have those, for insensitivity, for cruelty, for destructiveness. And it is a configuration, and you're quite right, gender is a huge part of it, but not because the female socialization in domination systems still has preserved that care, but it has lowered its importance and marginalized or ignored it.
Yeah, the fundamental point.
David, before you respond, I just want to interject this reflection. I heard what Rian said as complementary, not contrary to what you had said. Can you speak to that part as well?
Well, what we clearly agree on is that the fundamental issues are not genetic. They're cultural and institutional. And that's what tells us those things that are cultural and institutional are totally within our control. The institutions, it takes time to change them, but what's in our mind can change instantly.
I wanted to follow up later on what Rian was saying about. Go ahead, David.
The one thing where we may have some disagreement is the history of warfare. I totally agree that most traditional societies of the early societies were not engaged in warfare. But I've also learned that the idea that there was no warfare among these groups was not true. We had that here in the United States. So the early Indian Americans, they engaged in tribal warfare.
But that was much later, David, really.
Arguing about that is not where we need to put our attention at the moment.
I agree. I think it's important to not put men in a box that for always they've been socialized for domination. That's the point that.
That's quite true. One of my fascinating points in my discussions with Mamphelo Ramphele is her focus on the traditional perspective of Ubuntu. Ubuntu is the term they use in South Africa, but it's a concept that exists through much of Africa, which translates "I am because you are," which you take in the larger perspective is "I am because we are," but it also ties directly into the current findings of science and the breakthroughs in biology, particularly. As you mentioned, the bullshit in the old sciences, but we're seeing a huge breakthrough in science toward the recognition of interdependence in ways that are not mechanistic. That life is alive, life is conscious, life is intelligent, and life, as we're beginning to realize, only exists in communities that self-organize to create and maintain the conditions essential to their individual and mutual existence. And that is the fundamental frame in which we need to go forward as a species as we create the new civilization that's essential to our existence.
But so. I agree with everything just about, except for your reading of history. And I urge you to read Nurturing Our Humanity because it has the archaeological, anthropological DNA and linguistic evidence in it supporting that warfare is at most 5,000 to 10,000 years old.
Okay, that is not my field of specialization, so I'm not going to get into that argument.
But okay. I'm just suggesting that you look at the evidence.
Goes beyond what the evidence you're looking at. But yeah, Hazel.
Can I jump in a little bit from Ubuntu to the Golden Rule, which if you go to Wikipedia, there's about 50 pages on the Golden Rule. And it's very similar to Ubuntu. Basically, do as you would be done by. And it's in every language, in every culture, and it's gone back thousands of years and has allowed us actually to operate in community. And I wanted to just pick up on what Rian was talking about. What I see today is all of our wonderful children who are coming out there, and they do know what to do. The millions of school children now joining with the Extinction Rebellion people that are all over the streets. And they're saying, we do know what to do. We are going to build a totally new economy. And of course, what I remember is the economic cake model that I developed came out of the idea of this very one-dimensional pie chart that was always used. And I thought, we have to go from the pie to this much richer cake, which is the total productive system. And that cake diagram of mine has just gone all over the world since 1981, when I put it up in Politics of the Solar Age. And it just shows that the two top layers of the cake, the icing and the layer below it, are the only ones that are conducted in price system money metrics. And the thing rests on two lower layers of the cake, the third one being what I call the love economies. And that is all the caring, sharing, unpaid societies, which are much larger in every country than the price denominated market system, which is the official statistics. And of course, the bottom layer of the cake is Mother Nature. And the moment you forget, the economists don't count the productivity of nature and the productivity of the love economies, which I've just recently done another article about called Valuing Love Economies. Then, of course, the whole thing collapses eventually in financial crises and inflation and debt and all the things we're dealing with today. So I think that this generation of young men, they're completely different from the older generation, the old patriarchs who are dying out. The younger men that I know in the millennials, basically, they're perfectly happy with partnership, with their sisters, their wives, their lovers. They don't have any problem with this. And so I think that we're beating a dead horse, you know, that we know where to go. Let's follow our children.
I'll also mention that Hazel's work on the cake has been drawn on to develop something that's now being called donut economics.
That's right.
Kate Raworth. So we've gone from cake to donut.
Yeah. And actually, Kate and I did a webinar together exactly on that subject. And of course, when I did the cake, there was no scientific evidence about the nine planetary boundaries and all the rest of it. And she said she had my cake drawing stuck up in her office for about 10 years and had never found my book because, of course, you know, it wasn't very popular. She said that was a lot of the inspiration she made for the donut. So she and I now are working together. And it's just very exciting.
David, thank you for...
there's one point I want to make here. One of the things I've become very aware of is the larger framework is very simple. And one example of that is the need to go from domination to partnership. But the details of how you make it work are extraordinarily complex. And if you go to the deepest level, they are beyond anything that most of us have ever imagined. And the most foundational example is the human body. And this is, you know, this is what I was introduced to by Dr. Maewon Ho, a female biologist. Who was one of the most extraordinary people I've ever met. And this was back before biology had made this transition. But she just pointed out to me this absolutely obvious fact that we never think about, but it's obvious when pointed out, that we exist only because we have this body, which is a creation of tens of trillions of individual living cells, individual decision-making cells, including the microorganisms in our gut and elsewhere, that they are all self-organizing through processes that we still barely have the slightest understanding of to create and maintain this vehicle of our consciousness and instrument of our agency. So you take that analogy and then you go to Earth and all the interactions of all the different species to create and maintain on this planet conditions that, so far as we know, are unique. You know, in terms of statistics, there must be some others someplace because there are so many trillions of planets, but this is still the only one that we've identified that has surface conditions essential to life as we know it. And, you know, we've got to learn to organize in similarly complex, interdependent ways, which frankly go way beyond building a cake. And, you know, the donut economics, the key thing is the redefinition of the metrics by which we evaluate economic performance. And that, you know, that's where Kate's real contribution comes in, and she's brilliant in terms of the donut framework, but the inner and the outer circles that have to define the inner, the outer circle, the limits of a finite Earth and its regenerative capacities, and what are the indicators of the health of those those regenerative capacities. And then on the inner circle, the extent to which the economy is meeting the physical, essential physical needs of every human being. So then you get the economy in between those two circles, and how do we manage that to manage the balance of the circle? So I agree with you. She has a very sophisticated and very foundational framework.
One thing that I think we have to get into this conversation is the whole thing about human population. And to my way of thinking, this human population is very similar to other mammalian populations who are in breeding storms. This happens with all different mammalian species that, for one reason or other, they start overbreeding their carrying capacity. And so the behaviors, the first feedback loop from nature, is homosexuality and gender diversity, which of course limits reproduction. And the other is conflict over territory and all the rest of it. And then the cultural feedback loops, as we humans now with our big brains, we are now developing all of these cultural feedbacks to create a population on this planet. Probably, I think, will top out about what it is right now. And if we change all of our consumption behavior and production behavior, the planet probably could tolerate 7.5 billion humans. But this will require the changes that we're all talking about.
Folks, we are a few minutes over our prior time boundary. I have not been in denial about that, but just cherishing the conversation between these three passionate cultural leaders. I'm thinking that, and to the participants, forgive me for not bringing more direct attention to your questions and comments. As you saw, our three panelists had a lot to say to each other about each other's ideas. So I do want to draw your attention to what's in chat, because there are some very thoughtful comments, questions, as well as important resources there. You may want to copy chat, which Zoom allows you to do. and so you can refer back to it. And perhaps we can find another occasion to continue this conversation. Meanwhile, I want to invite our three panelists to just make brief closing comments. And I thought we might start with you, Rian, and you'll go where you choose to go. But I do have a nudge to offer. You, from the beginning in 87 in Chalice and the Blade, you chose the term cultural transformation theory to your theoretical underpinnings. And there are many ways in which we have been circling culture as the mystery to get our minds and hearts around in terms of reuniting care and economics. And in some ways, the difference in perspective between you, Rian, and David, which I initially missed, is also perhaps a cultural moment. So that was just my nudge to wherever you will go in your closing comments.
Well, thank you. And I want to thank David and Hazel and Aftab. And I really have been sort of, I'm very bad at multitasking, but I have tried to look at some of the chat, and there's some wonderful ideas and questions for which I thank you all. I think that we are talking about a cultural transformation, and that the work that Hazel and David and I are doing is precisely about that. The issue, as David said, is not that, I mean, I think we all agree more or less that it's from domination to partnership, but what are the mechanisms? And also what kind of configuration? The four cornerstones come into the foundations for either domination systems or partnership systems. And speaking of metrics, which I agree, I mean, Hazel has been a pioneer in this area. In terms of bringing care and economics together at the Center for Partnership Systems, and you can find out more about it at centerforpartnership.org, we have been working on what I call social wealth economic indicators and are now working to condense them into an index, because 24 indicators are a lot. And what it is really not only a new metric, but it is an educational transformational tool to show the economic value of the work of caring for people starting at birth, because we keep hearing about the need for high quality human capital, and we know from neuroscience that whether or not we have these resilient, capable, creative people depends largely on the quality of care and education children receive in the first 5 years, okay? And of course, caring for our natural life support systems. So if you're interested in that, please look at it. I think they complement Hazel's work a great deal, but go deeper to really showing the importance of the four cornerstones. So I think this has been a wonderful, and I've learned a lot during this conversation, for which I thank all of you. And I don't want to take any more time because we have so little time left. So bless you and thank you.
Thank you so much, Rian. And over to David or Hazel.
David, go ahead.
Yeah, this has been an amazing conversation. I think we've certainly are in very strong agreement on the fundamental frames of domination to partnership. The piece in terms of values that I think is so fundamentally important is the distinction between money and life. that we have become, we've created a society in which our dependence on money is so great that we tend to end up focusing on the money. And if we just had more money, all the problems would be solved. Mm-hmm. And forgetting, but money as we currently know it, I mean, it used to be gold, but imagine yourself on a desert island with a big case of gold. What do you eat? What do you drink? What the hell do you do with it? No, it's only useful as a medium of exchange because that's in our mind that it's a medium of exchange and somebody else will accept it. So this becomes very important when we start talking about these indicators. And I find my preference is that we need to really start with indicators that that are non-financialized, non-monetized, that money is not the foundational value. The foundational value is life mm-hmm. and the indicators of the well-being of life. And then when we get to money, as Hazel's pointed out, recognize money is a very useful tool, and humans have used it as a useful tool for a very long time. But as soon as you convert it into a purpose, I mean, as Pope Francis says, money's not evil. It's the worship of money that's evil. And that's exactly our situation.
So. Thank you. Thank you so much, David. And Hazel, perhaps in your storehouse, there's another story-transforming oxymoron.
Oh, well, I can just jump on what David just said. And we have for the past 10 years uplinked to PBS stations a one-hour special called The Money Fix, which is describing the politics of money creation, how it's created. All central banks create money. That's what they're supposed to do. The issue is, who do they give it to? You know, does it, the textbooks tell us they give it to the banks and it trickles down. You know, we know that doesn't work. So basically, what I'd like to end with is the fact that we are all right now living under tremendous stresses, self-induced stresses. We really don't know whether human beings will survive or become part of the sixth extinction. We're up to graduation time on this planet for sure. And what I take my hope for is basically knowing that stress is evolution's tool. And no species survives and thrives and evolves without stress, good stress. And so basically where we are now is that we forget that evolution never happens in nice, straight, orderly lines. The biologists call the process punctuated evolution, which means that evolution happens in jumps. We humans right now are going through an evolutionary jump, and there's a lot of good news in the jumps that are happening. And of course, there's a lot of bad news. And I spend the rest of my life trying to focus on the good jumps that are out there that we are creating now. And so I think we should all take a deep breath and realize that this is an evolutionary process, and that economies basically are simply living systems that we have created, we designed, and we as humans still have agency to change.
Thank you, Hazel. Thank you, Rian. Thank you, David. All of you for igniting our faith in the future. And thank you to everyone for your participation. Until next time at another crossroads, may we recognize each other. Goodbye for now. Goodbye for now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us. Integral Voices is produced by the Center for Transformative Learning at Meridian University. All episodes are available at meridianuniversity.edu/integralvoices. For more information about Meridian, including upcoming public courses, other podcasts and information sessions, visit meridianuniversity.edu. See you next time.